ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, tropical cyclone Narelle barrels across Cape York towards the Gulf of Carpentaria, bringing destructive winds and heavy rain. Also, we hear from one of the 20,000 seafarers stranded on ships near the Strait of Hormuz. And thousands of fans getting ready to cheer on the Tassie Devils in their first VFL game.
It's a momentous occasion. You know, Devils are finally back on the footy scene. And so I think it's important for the kids to really appreciate that and be there from the beginning. I think it's nice that they will grow up with football in Tasmania.
Communities on Queensland's northwest coast are taking shelter as fierce tropical cyclone Narelle moves across the country's north. Making landfall as a Category 4, it's one of the strongest storms to hit Queensland in the last 50 years. The system has been downgraded to a Category 2, but it's expected to strengthen in the Gulf of Carpentaria tonight as it heads towards the Northern Territory. Kimberly Price reports.
Gusts of up to 195 kilometres per hour have been recorded in far north Queensland as tropical cyclone Narelle travels west. Heavy rain has been falling with roads closed and bridges underwater. But miraculously, emergency services have reported no significant infrastructure damage or injuries caused by the storm. The town of Cowan is about 50 kilometres south of where the eye of the cyclone passed. David Kempton is the state member for Cook.
And amazingly, there's minimal damage and at this stage no report of injury. So it's kind of this massive sigh of relief.
As residents assess the damage, David Kempton says attention is turning to possible flash flood warnings.
The big issue now, of course, is the flooding. And from the photograph, there's one of the Cowan River and only the sign poking out above the water. So the flooding is yet to follow.
Wayne Coutts is the regional director of the State Emergency Service in Queensland's far northern region.
We're currently assessing all the locations to see if there's extra assistance that needs to be flown in to help with any of the recovery arrangements, anything with damage to roofs and that sort of stuff. But I've got to say, at the moment, it doesn't look too bad.
As tropical cyclone Narelle moves west, it's losing intensity. But authorities are warning residents not to become complacent. Arakoon, on Queensland's northwest coast, is located right in the cyclone's path and could see destructive wind gusts of up to 160 kilometres per hour or more. The town has lost its power and phone service. Premier David Crisafulli says he will travel to the affected areas this weekend to begin recovery efforts.
But it's important also that people know that just because they're small communities, it doesn't make them any less important. Far from it. They're part of who we are. They're part of our identity as a state and as a nation. And it's important that we're there for them. And I can assure you we will be.
Mick runs Schnack's Cafe in Weipa, about 2.5 hours drive north of Arakoon. He's preparing for the storm.
From this morning at 3 o'clock when I got up, yeah. Because I had to go down to the shop and suss the shop out, and then the rain started hit. Then, like you can hear the wind howling, which isn't a really good sign.
Tropical cyclone Narelle is expected to strengthen as it moves across the Gulf of Carpentaria before it impacts the Northern Territory later tomorrow. Shenna Gamble is from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Our current track has the central core of the cyclone passing over Groote Eylandt from overnight tomorrow as a Category 3 cyclone. On Groote Eylandt, around the centre of the cyclone, we can expect peak wind gusts of around 190 to 200 kilometres per hour.
Tides are expected to be higher than usual, while rainfall could exceed 200 millimetres. As Catherine recovers from a major flood last week, it's a nervous wait for locals.
The catchment is saturated. It means that any rain that happens in and around Catherine will cause flooding. This morning we've issued a major flood warning for the Catherine River.
Government disaster recovery funding is available across communities in Queensland and the Northern Territory.
Kimberly Price. Turning to the crisis in the Middle East, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is keeping open the possibility of sending ground troops into Iran, telling reporters you can't start a revolution from the air. Here in Australia, the tensions arising from the conflict have been on show, with the Prime Minister heckled while visiting a mosque in Sydney. David Sparks has more.
Relentless bombing continues in the Middle East, coming from Israel, the US and Iran, and hitting many countries in the region. Israel also has soldiers on the ground in Lebanon, and now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has indicated he's also willing to put troops on the ground in Iran.
It is often said that you can't win, you can't do revolutions from the air. That is true. You can't do it only from the air. You can do a lot of things from the air, and we're doing, but there has to be a ground component as well. There are many possibilities for this ground component, and I take the liberty of not sharing with you all those possibilities.
There's been heavy criticism of Israel for striking Iran's enormous offshore gas field, South Pars. Prime Minister Netanyahu now says, at the request of Donald Trump, that won't happen again, although heavy strikes on other parts of Iran continue, especially Tehran. Iran is also aiming to strike energy infrastructure. It's attacked oil and gas facilities in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and other countries. The humanitarian toll is growing. Thousands have been killed and many hundreds of thousands displaced. US President Donald Trump is clearly unhappy with the lack of support from major allies in his efforts to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Sitting alongside the Japanese Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, he was asked why he hadn't warned those allies he was about to bomb Iran.
One thing you don't want to signal too much, you know, when we go in, we went in very hard and we didn't tell anybody about it because we wanted surprise. Who knows better about surprise than Japan? Okay, why didn't you tell me about Pearl Harbor? Okay.
In Australia, as this war rolls on, alongside the 2.5-year-old war in Gaza, social divisions are showing. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke were invited to Lekemba Mosque in southwest Sydney today to mark Eid, the end of Ramadan. As they sat inside the mosque, the heckling started. A handful of men shouted at the Prime Minister, while other men pleaded with them to stop.
Respect the place you're in, please. This is a mosque.
The man trying to make a speech while the hecklers shouted was Jamal Keir, secretary of the Lebanese Muslim Association, which runs the mosque.
Look, disappointed that it happened inside the mosque, but not surprised. I knew this was going to be a controversial position that the mosque committee took, but I stand behind it. We may not have all the answers, but the intentions were to try and reopen some form of dialogue with government to express our growing unease and concern about what's happening in Australia and overseas.
Do you know the individuals who were heckling the Prime Minister?
No, I don't. And I was being heckled myself, so I was more concentrated on giving that speech. But again, you know, I don't know who they are, but putting it into context, David, which is very important, there was 40,000 people today and there was four hecklers.
Anthony Albanese was later asked about the incident. He said he'd received an incredibly positive reception at the mosque and the hecklers were not supported by the community there.
David Sparks reporting. At least 20,000 seafarers are stuck on cargo ships stranded in the Persian Gulf because of the Iranian blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Dozens of countries, including Australia, are pushing for the urgent creation of what's being called a humanitarian corridor in the strait to allow the seafarers to escape to safety. Conditions on board the 3,000 or so vessels are deteriorating, with some on board having panic attacks and reporting shortages of water, food and fuel. Rachel Hayter prepared this report.
This stranded Filipino seafarer, whose identity we're protecting, has been languishing on a cargo ship in the Persian Gulf for weeks.
The situation here isn't easy. We hear disturbing sounds while working and we can even see missile attacks in the distance.
The Iranian blockade of the Strait of Hormuz since the end of February has stranded more than 3,000 cargo ships in the war zone, with more than 20,000 civilian seafarers seafarers on board, enduring missiles flying past, threatening their lives.
There's fear and dread among us, and some of my colleagues are now experiencing panic attacks and anxiety. There's not a single day that passes without us receiving alert messages on our phones about elevated risks and urging us to stay vigilant.
Reno Bolivar is a former seafarer and the founder of Marino PH, a support centre for maritime professionals in the Philippines. He's been fielding pleas for help from Filipino seafarers trapped in the Gulf.
The majority of them now, they have this anxiety, depressed, and waiting for the airspaces to open, a repatriation. Most of them right now, especially those in the anchorage and drifting area, since no movement, some of them are already lack of supplies of the basic needs like fresh water, provision, food, or even fuel. The complaint is majority of this about their safety, their security, the danger, the missile, the drone, the bomb.
The International Maritime Organization held an extraordinary session this week to address the war's impact on shipping. Secretary General of International Federation of Shipmasters Associations, Captain Andrew Cook, expressed his deep concern for the safety of stranded seafarers.
We've got hundreds of ships with 20,000 seafarers. That's the number that's being talked about, but actually that's a conservative number. It's probably going to be more than that.
The International Maritime Organization heard more than 18 merchant ships of various nationalities have been hit by projectiles, missiles, drone boats, and sea mines. At least 7 seafarers have been confirmed dead, 4 are missing, and several others have been severely injured.
You've got seafarers who are sitting on board a steel box, basically imprisoned because they can't get off the ship and the ship can't move. If they're working on board tankers, they're surrounded by oil and gas. And some of them are being targeted by missiles.
Dozens of countries, including Australia, are pushing for the urgent creation of a humanitarian corridor in the Strait of Hormuz to allow the seafarers to escape to safety. Professor Natalie Klein from the University of New South Wales researches the laws of the sea.
At the moment, it's just not certain that they can get safely through the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Persian Gulf to the Gulf of Oman and then further out to the rest of the world. So the worry is that these ships, they are perhaps flagged to a state that is considered an enemy of Iran, and Iran will fire on it, or Iran will just be concerned that those ships are carrying goods that will be used by Iran's enemies.
Professor Klein explains the working rights of seafarers are already relatively poor.
The risk for these seafarers is that if they leave their ships, then they're going to be breaching their contracts potentially and they won't get paid. And further, they might end up getting blacklisted and not be able to get work on ships in the future. So we're dealing with a very vulnerable category of workers, and with more than 20,000 of them affected, there really needs to be action taken to secure their safety.
Action this stranded Filipino seafarer hopes comes sooner rather than later.
My only wish is for my family to keep us in their prayers, to keep us safe here, because anything can happen. I hope this chaos comes to an end. There are so many innocent lives being affected.
A Filipino seafarer stranded in the Persian Gulf. That report from Rachel Hayter. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on ABC Listen. Ahead, Tassie footy fans getting ready to barrack for the Devils in their first VFL match tomorrow. The South Australian state election is on tomorrow, and it's expected that Peter Malinauskas and his Labor Party will have a huge win. When it comes to the conservative side of politics, pundits are closely watching whether One Nation can win more votes than the Liberal Party. Isabel Masali reports.
At this pre-poll centre in Adelaide's north, undecided voters line up with those who've already made up their minds.
I think we'll stick with whatever we have in the state at the moment, yeah, and then see how we go. But yeah, I think they're doing okay.
I've been a very avid Liberal voter all my life. However, this year I am still going in this queue and I still don't know who to vote for.
While opinion polling predicts another sweeping victory for Labor, Premier Peter Malinauskas is urging South Australians to treat their votes seriously.
My government has a record
people standing up and fighting for South Australia and advancing the interests of our people in our country. And we've made a difference.
The campaign has focused on cost of living, health policy and economic opportunities. Liberal leader Ashton Hearn has only had 3 months in the role. She's been seizing on Labor's failed promise to fix ambulance ramping.
I'm a straight shooter. If I say I'm going to do something, then that's exactly what I'm going to do. And that's in contrast to Peter Malinauskas.
Another fierce competitor for the Liberal Party is One Nation. On a federal level, polling shows One Nation matching and even outpolling the coalition. Tomorrow's state election is considered to be their first test since this polling boost. Ashton Hearn has ruled out forming a coalition with One Nation and is still hoping to become Premier.
I'm excited about the opportunity, should it come our way, to roll out our program of policies.
Late today, it was revealed that One Nation's candidate for Adelaide, Aoi Baxter, has a warrant for his arrest in the UK for failing to show up to court after he was charged with an alleged sexual offence. In a statement, One Nation said it will cooperate with police. His profile has been removed from the party's website.
Isabel Massali reporting. Clem McIntyre is an emeritus professor of politics at Adelaide University, and I asked him if today's revelation that the One Nation candidate for the seat of Adelaide, Aoi Baxter, is wanted by police in the UK, will affect that party's vote.
I don't think it'll affect the broad statewide vote all that much, and there was never any prospect of One Nation doing well in the seat of Adelaide itself. It might cost a few votes, and it'll probably shave a bit off the vote for the upper house. So it's obviously significant implications for the candidate in Adelaide, but that was a seat that One Nation had no prospects in.
One Nation says it did an Australia-wide police check on Mr. Baxter, but should it have picked up an outstanding warrant overseas?
Well, you would hope that they'd be asking the candidate, is there any other information that might be relevant to their candidature? And I guess if they'd done that, the candidate wasn't being very honest in his replies. So, yes, in one sense, you could criticise the party for not doing due diligence on their candidate. And I think that's one of the problems you sometimes see when parties rise very quickly. So One Nation's been around for a long time, but the levels of support have grown very rapidly in recent years, and they were very keen to have a candidate in every one of the lower house seats in South Australia. And I think that sometimes means for small parties that there is a need to look very carefully at the candidates. Big parties, of course, frequently are selecting candidates that have been a member for a long time. They're well known. The party knows a lot about them. That's not always the case for minor parties. And it looks like One Nation have stumbled in regard to the candidate in Adelaide.
Which South Australians are likely to vote One Nation for the first time, do you think?
Well, if the polls are right, that's going to be a fair proportion of South Australians. Despite Pauline Hanson's denial of it, I think that I would still describe One Nation as a party of disaffection. They're largely picking up voters principally from the Liberal Party, but some also from Labor, who are just expressing frustration with the major parties. There's concern over ramping of ambulances outside hospitals in South Australia. There's still concern over housing and so on. And voters have seen governments of both parties really failing to resolve some of those problems. And I think there's also an element where there's a bit of a backlash against the sort of political correctness that some voters see in the major parties.
Do you think One Nation can win any seats in the South Australian lower house?
It's going to be tough because of the number of candidates that we're seeing in South Australia. Some of the seats have got 8, 9 candidates, and following a flow of preferences on election night is going to be very challenging because of that. If One Nation can garner more votes than the Liberals, and the polls are telling us that looks like it's the case at the moment, and probably more likely to be the case in some of the rural seats, and stay ahead of the Liberal Party and perhaps benefit from Liberal Party preferences if they're eliminated earlier in the count, then yes, it's possible they will win a couple of seats, but I don't think it's going to be a substantial number. I suspect the Liberal Party will be returned with more seats than One Nation. The Liberals will lose some to Labor in the metropolitan area. They're in danger of losing a couple at least in rural areas to independents, high-profile independents who've either stood in the previous state election or the federal election, and obviously this new challenge posed by One Nation. And they will, of course, I think, win a couple of seats at least in the state upper house.
Why do you think it's going to be such a resounding win for Peter Malinauskas and his Labor Party?
A combination of factors. One is to do with Peter Malinauskas himself. He's a remarkably successful and polished politician and the professionalism of Labor. And historically, the Liberals in South Australia have been a very unsuccessful party in office for fewer than 20 of the last 60 years. It's a party that often sees pretty powerful divisions inside it. Internal squabbles become public. I don't think it's been a strong opposition for the past 4 years. And when you put that against the popularity of Peter Malinauskas and the sheer professionalism of Labor, I think that largely explains why they are very clear favourites to win this election.
The Liberal leader is Ashton Hearn, a first-term MP. How do you think she's performed during this campaign?
I think very creditably, but she's only been in the post for a few months. And so it has been very difficult for her to turn around the decline in support for the Liberals. And as I say, facing the emergent challenge of One Nation, that's compounded her problems. Having said that, I think she's performed well on the hustings. She's faced the Premier a couple of times in debates, and those marking her have scored it either as a narrow win to the Premier or a draw. But I think that's probably a better result than the Liberals would have hoped before the change to Ashton Hearn as leader in December.
Clem McIntyre is an Emeritus Professor of Politics at Adelaide Uni. And there will be a special edition of AM on Sunday morning with analysis of the South Australian election results. There's a milestone coming up for the new Tassie Devils Footy Club tomorrow. While they're not due to play in the AFL until 2028 and questions remain over the building of their stadium, the team will run out onto the North Hobart Oval for their first match. The game is tipped to be a sellout, and that could set a record for the largest ever crowd at a VFL home and away game. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
In Tasmania, the anticipation is building. The state is a footy heartland, but for the first time this Saturday, fans will be able to cheer on their own Devils team. Kirsty Bain is taking her three children along.
They are very excited. They love their football.
For the young family, it's about more than just this game.
It's a momentous occasion. You know, Devils are finally back on the footy scene. And so I think it's important for the kids to really appreciate that and be there from the beginning. I think it's nice that they will grow up with football in Tasmania and being able to see it regularly. So we'll make the most of it.
The players are feeling the excitement too. Jai Menzies will lead the team out as they face off against Coburg.
I feel like everywhere you go, someone's asking you about the Devils. Like, the movement's massive. Got so much momentum. And that's why we get to put it on show here in a packed house at North Hobart. So I think most games will obviously probably be sellouts and it's going to be so special.
It's a really significant moment.
Brendan Gale is the Devils' chief executive. He's predicting a sellout crowd of just over 11,000 people.
It would be huge and, you know, it would break records. I understand it would be the biggest home and away crowd in the VFL. And that's, you know, including, you know, VFL teams in Melbourne.
The Devils have already signed up more than 15,000 people to full memberships since they went on sale last month, after selling over 200,000 $10 foundation memberships across the past 2 years.
This is a football state that has had an aspiration to have a team in the AFL for many, many years. And for years we've been told we're not good enough, we're not big enough, or we're too parochial, etc. And we've got an opportunity. This is a VFL game, but it's our first step in the runway towards our participation in Australia's biggest sport, which is the AFL.
Brendan Gale says playing VFL this year and next is crucial in order to prepare the Tasmania Devils for their national AFL debut in 2028.
We need to put ourselves under the heat and find out what we're made of. So we're going to make mistakes, and some will be costly mistakes, but we need to reflect and learn and grow and improve. And so in that context, the next 2 years are critically important. for our evolution into the AFL and our readiness.
The game's set to start just after midday on Saturday.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting from Hobart. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is John Stewart. The associate producer is Tanya Dendrinos. Technical production by Joram Toth and David Sargent. I'm Samantha Donovan. We'll be back on Monday evening. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Are the petrol stations ripping us off? Are they cashing in on the Iran war? And if they are, is there anything that can stop them? Today, David Byrne, Professor of Economics at Melbourne Uni, on how the fuel companies justify the rapid price rises and what motorists can do to counter them. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.